I'm an alcoholic. My name's Keith.
Hi, Keith.
By God's grace, Alcoholics Anonymous room's full of people like you in a fast backfield. It hadn't been necessary for me to take a drink or do no dope since May 11, 1976, and for that I'm forever grateful. It's a privilege for me to be here. It's a privilege for me to be anywhere in my right mind and fully clothed. And it's a special treat to be able to be asked to come down and spend an afternoon with my friends. I got friends today. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I ran out of friends and enemies at the same time. So anything that I got from that point on was up. I was born in Texas, and that's not reason enough to be an alcoholic. But so that you don't get it confused, the difference between a fairy tale and a Texas tale, I'll tell you. A fairy tale starts out once upon a time, and a Texas tale starts out, you're probably not going to believe this crap, but I'm going to tell you anyway. So, I used to sit around, drink a little beer, and think maybe I'll do something. And then I'd smoke a little dope and kind of fantasize how I was going to do it. And I'd snort a little coke so I'd be cool when I did it. And I'd shoot a little speed so I'd be strong when I did it. And I'd drink a little whiskey and forget what the hell it was I was going to do. So, I drank alcohol until I achieved pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, bought myself a bag of weed and a Harley Davidson, became a legend in my own mind is what I did. There's probably some legends here tonight, I can feel them. But really what happened to me, I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous but for one reason. I came a direct result of Al-Anon brutality. I was standing around a little rodeo dance in the Texas Panhandle one Saturday night. I wasn't doing nothing, and when I wasn't doing nothing, well, I just started doing something. And I was in between divorces, and I didn't happen to have a driver's license at that particular time. And I didn't have any money, didn't have any job, I didn't have a girlfriend, didn't have a drink. And I'm the kind of an alcoholic. I mean, drinking was a contact sport for me. I really enjoyed that. So at midnight when the band would take a little intermission, why, if I was doing nothing like it was when I was there, why, I'd take something like a Coke bottle and roll it down. They had a big old dance or thing like this stage. You roll a Coke bottle down, let it hit the bottom, said, let the meanest sucker in the house bring it back. And it looks like a stampede in your direction. And I'd done that. And you see, I had a philosophy. I never lost a lot of fights. I never stayed around until they were over. That's the key. I'd start a fight, and then I'd go to the woman's restroom and hide. And so I was running to this woman's restroom, and this blonde-headed lady was standing there. And I said, tell me whenever the cops leave and the fight's over. And she did. Pretty soon she said, you can come out now, and I did, and out of courtesy, I asked her to dance. And during that dance, I found out she had a job, she had a driver's license, she had a car, and I asked her to take me home with her, is what I did. I didn't realize that she was a potential Al-Anon, so we dated for a couple of years. I never wanted to rush right into anything, and during a couple of years, we didn't fall in love with each other. We fell in sick with each other is what we did. And she didn't drink much and, stuff like that. Healed real quick. She'd get mad and jump out of the car going 35, 40 miles an hour. And in a couple of weeks, you couldn't even tell she did it, And so we got married. I mean, what the hell? She had a job, driver's license, car, all kinds of neat things. After a period of time, it became necessary for me to do an Alcoholics Anonymous. I think they call it a geographic. It was necessary for me to get the hell out of Texas. I came to California. What that really was unlawful flight to avoid prosecution is what it was. And by that time, I had this lady. I had about a 6.5-year-old girl. I had a 120-pound German Shepherd dog that hated me, and I had a neutered cat that hated me. And if you want to get a cat that'll hate you, you take him down and get his balls cut off and let him know who did it. And I had made a terrible mistake. I forgot to get him declawed at the same time. And my friend and I went over to his girlfriend's place. She worked in a pharmacy, and we got a couple of bags of these pills. Just took a little bit of everything. and put them in one big baggie, and I left Oklahoma City to come to California. It took me 30 days with that crew to get out here, you know. And by the time I got to California, everybody was nuts. And I had to find a place to put them. And I never was one that liked to geographic the people around me too much. I liked to put them someplace and then let me go. And so I found this house. It was perfect for me. One of the best dope connections in Orange County was on one side of me, and the Haitians were working on the other side out of a house there doing mud wrestling before it was popular. It didn't have no front yard, didn't have no backyard, and across the street, everybody had their yards manicured, looked perfect. Sunday morning, everybody come out with suits on, had nice cars, had the kids dressed, and went to church. I could sit over there in my garage, smoke dope, drink beer, and watch my neighbors leave, and tell everybody I just liked them. And I'd do that. I'd sit over there in my garage, and these people across the street do all kinds of things. Guy lived right across the street from me. He was a school teacher. He came over one day. I was sitting out in my garage, and he said, "I'd like to paint your house." And I said, "Oh, yeah, what color would you like to paint?" I mean, I've been trying to paint it for quite a while. I had one end that was blue, and one end that was brown. One end that was, you know, a different color, and so he told me what color he'd like to paint it, and I asked him, "How come you want to paint my house?" He said, "Well, I'm going to put mine up for sale, and I don't want yours to look okay so I can get the hell out of the neighborhood." So he painted my house. I saw then I had a couple old cars parked out front, and he wanted to haul them off too. And I said, "Well, I don't know if I want you to haul my old cars off, because when I get loaded, that's kind of my backstop. I can run up there and hit it." He promised me he'd pay me if I'd let him take them cars away. And I had a friend that had an old boat, was looking for a place to put it. And I figured, what the hell, we could put the boat out there. And we did. And we'd sit out in that boat and make funny noises, man, and play like we was fishing. And had a hell of a good time. And periodically I'd have to work. And I'd have to go away and work for some period of time. And working made me tired. And I'd have to come home. And periodically I'd have to come home to rest. Now, I had this woman living at this house, and this little kid living at that house, and that dog living at that house, and that cat living at that house, and it's like when I'd come home to rest, that woman's mouth would be attached to the doorknob. And when I'd open that door, she'd just come up me something fierce. And I'd get inside there, and I made a mistake one time. I snuck up on her in the kitchen, and she had a butcher knife. And she never put the butcher knife down for 10 years after that. And she had this butcher knife around in there, and I'd come roaring in there wanting to rest. And she'd set up booby traps inside the door, like these pots and pans around inside the door. And I'd go roaring through the door and step in one of them pans. And I wore cowboy boots, and it's hard to get your gun out of your boot and defend yourself when you got your boot stuck in a pan. And this woman would be swinging this butcher knife around, the dog would be biting me in the ass, and the cat would be scratching me, and the kid would be bawling. And I'm trying to say, "Daddy's home, for Christ's sake." Man, I come all the way from a long ways away. No mercy, man, no mercy. And they'd yell and scream at me till, I don't know, must have been 2 or 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And I took a lot of amphetamines. I was a speed freak because I didn't want to miss nothing. And if you don't know what a speed freak's like, it's like going 150 miles an hour with your feet nailed to the floor. My biggest fear was that my body was going to die and my head was going to keep on living. And it'd be 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and I'd be tired. I got to rest. I ain't slept in 5, 6 days, something like that. And I'd be in there and finally crank it down and lay down, maybe sleep for an hour. If you're a speed freak, you come to real quick. Blackouts are short. Come to in high gear. Jump straight up. When you get up, you got to do something. I always had to get my heart started once I got up. And I'd go out in the kitchen, take about 150 mini-bennies, put them in the blender, put a couple of raw eggs in there, some orange juice, turn that baby on. Give me a big iced tea glass, filled up with vodka, put a little Tabasco in that baby so I could drink that, take that, and then I'd have to think, maybe I ought to mow the front yard. I'd go out in the garage, try to find a lawnmower. Had a lawnmower, no muffler on it. I wanted everybody to know I was mowing my front yard. I'd go out in the garage, try to find a lawnmower, and 30 minutes later, if I could find the lawnmower, it didn't make no difference whether I could find the rope or not, because them bennies would hit you and you could push start your lawnmower with it. My lawnmower, it didn't run very good. And one time it run out right in the middle of when I was in the middle of mowing my front yard and around my house. If it don't run, you shoot it. I killed my lawnmower in the front yard. Cops come out there and arrested me. Run my head into their nightstick for 15 minutes. Had a bunch of dope fiends next door. They were weirded out, and they'd get out there and call them cops pigs, and the cops would beat the hell out of me. And then that woman would come out and say, "Don't take him away. He's got to fix the house up because he's got to leave on Monday." And I'd go back in the house, and then that'd make me depressed, and I'd have to sit down in my chair. I had a depression chair at my house, an old recliner. had a bunch of seed burns in it. I had bad dope and was blowing them seeds out, burning it, and had wine around it, you know. But it just had a special feel where you could lay there and suck on a wine jug, you know. And I had a sawed-off shotgun down beside it, and I could jack that baby back and stick the barrel of it in my mouth and click it off. It's empty, of course. I wanted them people to know I was getting depressed and I was seriously thinking about suicide. One time that woman put a shell in that gun, man. I seen something red, clicked her back, pulled it off just in time, blowed the air conditioner right out of the wall. Thing fell out on the outside, running around out there. We had a hell of a fight, you know, and I couldn't hear for 3 days. I think it was a couple of days before it dawned on me that if my neighbor had been walking by, I'd have killed him, you know. And then the cops would come back, and I'd have to get out in front, run my head into their nightstick 2 or 3 more times, and they'd put one of them funny coats on me, the buttons in the back, and then they'd go put me in the car, and then she'd come out, and she'd say, don't take him away, because he's got to get ready for to leave Monday to go to work, and I'd go back in the house, and then I'd have to think how I was going to escape, and I couldn't go in my car, because I'd run over the curb in my car and it wasn't working, and so I'd have to sneak her keys and get some money, make a mad dash out, get in the car, throw it in reverse, go down the driveway and turn around, and she'd be on the hood. I don't know if there's any hood riders in here, but you got a crazy woman on the hood beating on the window, sober you right up. I have to run right back up in the driveway, get out, drag her off the hood, the dog would be barking. That makes you tired, man. You get tired. I did that until I couldn't do it anymore, and then one morning I found myself standing in front of a judge, and he was talking something real strange. He was talking about sending me to the penitentiary for something I didn't remember doing. And he's made some stupid mistake. He asked me if I'd consider going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I made some kind of a deal with him. I told him, well, maybe I would. It sounded better than what he was talking about. And so I went home, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. The guy told me about a meeting, and he told me where it was, and I laid down to think about it. This woman asked me, said, what time's that meeting start? And I said, 8:30. About 8 o'clock, she come roaring in there with that butcher knife. She said, get up. I said, why? She said, we're going to that meeting. So I go out and get in the car. The cops have taken all my guns. Couldn't defend myself. Go get in the car. She drives over there. She said, what time's the meeting over? I said, 10. She said, Ace, I'm going to tell you something. If you come out of that door before 10, I'm going to gut you. Now, you can keep a drunk sober if you got a big enough knife and a crazy woman. Because for 4 months, I stayed sober. An amazing thing happened to me, going to one meeting a week, 4 months. Didn't drink, do nothing, just miserable all the time. And I sat in that meeting, they talked about the steps and sponsor and all kinds of stuff. I did not want to hear that, but I didn't drink. And I was sitting in my house, and all of a sudden it dawned on me. I looked around, man. That woman let me back in the bedroom, got my job back. That judge let me off the deal. The dog's laying right beside my old chair. I could pet him. The cat was in my lap just purring away, and the kid was over here, and I pet the kid. And I thought to myself, I've been too hard on myself. I've come here too premature. I've got at least 10 more years of drinking. And I went back and resigned from that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And an unbelievable thing happened to me. A gin Mary jumped right in my hand. And I drank two of them, and nothing happened. I went up in my room, got me a handful of pills, took a bunch of Quaaludes and some Reds, went back and had another drink, and something happened. I stayed drunk for 3.5 years. For 3.5 years, I stayed drunk and never breathed a sober breath. And a lot of things happened to me that they talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous. Bad, bad things. Things that I didn't even believe would happen to me. Things like I found myself being arrested many, many times. There was a few times in there I was arrested for vagrancy and a few things like that, but after I come back to Alcoholics Anonymous, my sponsor made me go look these up, and in that 3.5 years, I've been arrested 57 times for assault and battery and resisting arrest, and 31 times had to do with me beating my wife or my daughter. If I couldn't get a fight going anywhere else, I'd come home. And a lot of things happened to me. I got in a car wreck, and people were hurt bad and killed, and I found myself crazed out running up in Nevada with a bunch of bikers and got in a fight and beat a guy to death, you know, just all kinds of crazy things happened to me, and I couldn't understand it. And finally, you know, like I said, I run out of friends and enemies at the same time, and I ended up coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, there's a funny thing about a guy like me. I won't take a look at me until everybody else is gone. I mean, as long as there's one man, woman, child, dog, or cat that'll roll over when I snap my fingers, I won't look at me. It's a funny thing about, you know, change, man. It got so bad that there wasn't nobody around. I mean, the hate was gone, and there wasn't nothing left but just nothing. And that's why I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I lived that way for 1.5 years. And I finally came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Once I got in Alcoholics Anonymous and they told me, here it is, baby, and I knew I was home. The only problem was I was full of hate. I was full of fear. And I'd sit around this detox they put me in. They took and put me in a detox unit. I'd been to lots of places, jails and nut wards and all kinds of things. But I sat in this detox unit, and I was sitting there with one of them funny robes on. Don't have any back in it, you know. And you're on one of them old cold couches. And some ding-a-ling come walking in there. Man had a big book under his arm, all dooted out, slick-looking, had a big diamond ring on. And he come over and sat right next to me. And he said something stupid like, are you an alcoholic? I said, well, I don't know what the hell I'd be doing here if I wasn't, you know. I mean, look at me. And he says, well, I just asked you, are you an alcoholic? And I said, well, I must be. He says, your life unmanageable. And I said, I don't know. I don't have nothing to manage. He said, are you crazy? And I said, hell, I don't know. You would tell me. You're so smart. He said, I'll show you in the book. And he opened the book up and started showing in there how I was probably a real alcoholic, because he showed me in that book. Says right here, a real alcoholic, someone who's insanely drunk most of the time. And I said, that's me. And he said, well, tell you what, if you want to work this program, we'll show you how. And he started explaining all kinds of stuff to me about inventory stuff. I did not want to look at myself, I'll guarantee you, especially sitting there bare-assed on that couch. And he started explaining a whole bunch of stuff to me I didn't understand about character defects and weird stuff like that, and I didn't understand that. I knew some of the things he was talking about because people had been talking to me about them for a long time. And then he started talking about making amends, said I was going to have to make amends to people and put things on a piece of paper, and then I was going to have to run right out there and make those amends. I did not want to think about that either, I'll guarantee you. And then he said something about there'll be some promises, and he said the fear of people will leave you. I said, when? He said, when you quit hanging around with people who want to kill you. I said, oh, that makes kind of sense to me. You know? He said, you will intuitively know how to do things which you didn't know, used to baffle you. And I said, what's that? He said, well, you're so sick that you'll probably have to go to a meeting every single day for at least 22 years. And after you get 22 years, you can come back and we might let you have a day off. I said, what's that got to do with this? He said, then you will intuitively know something. And I said, what's that? He said, you'll intuitively know that you're going to have to go to a meeting every single day for at least 22 years. I said, oh, that makes sense. I said, what about all this God stuff? He said, well, we just got to keep it real simple with a guy like you because you're weird. I said, I understand that. I said, but what about going to all these meetings and churches where they got crosses and all kinds of stuff? Don't like that. I'm an atheist. He said, you are? I said, yeah, I'm an atheist. He went and got a dictionary. Funny how he could find one right there in the detox. Opened it up. Looked in there and he had me read the definition of an atheist. I didn't even understand it. He said, see there, you're going around and say you are something you don't even understand. I said, I know I'm crazy. He said, that's right. He said, I'm going to tell you something about God. He said, the only thing you got to know about God is there is one and you ain't him. And I said, oh, okay. That simplified that. Then he said, I was going to have to pray every day and I didn't understand and do a whole bunch of other things. And then pretty soon he got up and he took off and I said, hey, will you be my sponsor? And he said, yeah. I knew I had to have that just to get out of the detox. And so I got out of that detox and I went back home. That crazy woman was still in that house, and that kid, and that dog, and that cat. I went in that house and I said, look, I got to go to Alcoholics Anonymous meeting every single day, one day at a time, for 22 years. What are you going to do? They said, oh, we've been going to Al-Anon, Al-Ateen, Al-Dog, and Al-Cat. So we don't already know what we got to do. What are you going to do? I had to call my sponsor up and say, what am I going to do? He said, get ready. We're going to go someplace to a meeting. I was going to a meeting. I was crazy. I was just hanging around. I like to come into a meeting like this and sit down in between two people and radiate hate. And pretty soon one of them would get up and say, I think I'll get me a cup of coffee and look at the other, and they'd leave and never come back. And I'd sit around meetings. I went to one meeting up in Anaheim. Bunch of the weirdest people I ever saw. Some guy'd be sitting in there and he'd be saying weird, I mean real weird, sick stuff. I'd take my .38 out of my boot, get a bullet out, take a Pentatel pen and write his name on the bullet and hold it up and say, I'm going to kill you right after the meeting. Put the bullet back in, put it in. Some other guy'd start talking about some sick stuff, man, and I'd get to thinking about him. I always had this ability to recognize your problem and a real need to tell you about him. You know, I thought the world was sheep and I had the shears. And I'd take the bullet out and write his name on it and stick it back in there. I'd think I'm going to kill him right after the meeting. Pretty soon they'd get up, put their arms around each other, say a prayer, and I'd forget which one I was going to kill first. And they'd say, keep coming back. And I would. And I'd go home, stand around that house, had to go to work. guy told me, you've got to go to work. So I went and asked for my job. Guy told me I was going to have to go to work in Canada. I went to my sponsor. He'd been telling me I had to do this inventory, and I'd been writing some things. I was really, what I was doing was an immoral inventory, and I was writing this bad, bad stuff down because I wanted to impress you guys. And so I was writing all this bad stuff down, and I went to my sponsor and says, I got to go to Canada and go to work. He said, where are you going in Canada? And I told him. He said, just a minute. Come over to my house before you leave. I went over to his house, and he gave me a bottle of vitamins. I said, what's that for? And he says, just as soon as you get to that town in Canada, you call this phone number and tell this guy you have these vitamins. So I roared all the way up there, man, got way back in the back part of Canada, got me a room, called this phone number. Guy answered. I said, I got some vitamins. He said, don't move. Where are you? I told him. Come right over and knocked on my door. I handed him the vitamins. Didn't look like he was sick to me. And he said, thanks for the vitamins. Get your fourth step. Let's go. I said, how did you know I had a fourth step? And he said, because the only people that bring me vitamins that got a fourth step. And I went with him and I told him all this stuff, man. I told him my sick, sick, real sick stuff. And he didn't, I don't remember what he said. It didn't really impress him. And he kind of said something stupid like, if I could have done that, I wouldn't have quit. And I don't love you any less for what you did. And he gave me a hug, and I went back and went to work. Pretty soon I come back, flew all the way back down here, went to see my sponsor. I said, I told that guy all my stuff up there, give him the vitamins, you tricked me. He says, I know, I already know about all about your fifth step, because just as soon as you told that guy, he called me and told me, so two of us said no. And he said, now what you got to do is a moral inventory. And I said, no, I ain't. It's going to be a long time before I do that. And he says, no, it won't. It'll be right before you drink. And he was right. And then I had to do something weird, like get on my knees and pray. And I had to say that third step prayer. And I'd be running around just crazy in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous saying, I've done the third step. A week later, I'd be in the same meeting, nuts in there just ranting and raving. And they'd say, I thought you did the third step. I said, how do you know when you did the third step? And they'd say, oh, you'll know. You'll know. And I'd go running around. I was working up in Wyoming, man. I was working back in the oil fields. And I come roaring home. I don't know. I was about 2.5 years sober. I had it all together, and I run in that house, went in there, and there's that woman. I said, get in the bedroom. I've been up there in the mountains, and I'm home. She says, no, I've gone to Al-Anon, and I've discovered for the last 10 years you never made love to me. You've raped me on a regular basis, and I'm releasing your ass. Sleep on the couch. I thought, man, I'm sober. I'm doing all these things. I'm being able to find out things about me. I'm growing spiritual. I can talk to God, done the prayer and everything else. Then I got to sleep on the couch. I'm laying on the couch about 12:30, 1 o'clock. Pretty soon she come running down the hallway. She said, them dope fiend neighbors next door are mowing their backyard, can't sleep. I said, the hell they are. Jumped up off the couch, run down the hallway, grabbed a .44 Magnum out the back door, leaned over the fence and blowed that hippie's lawnmower up right there in front of her. His eyes about that big around. She ran out there and threw her arms around and said, I just love you, Daddy, when you're a hero, and took me right in there and threw one on me. You know, I just crazy, you know. I was single-handedly cleaning up a neighborhood that had been corrupt for many years. Got me a big car, man. I got me a big car. Everybody's got to have an AA card about 3 years sober. Big Lincoln hood as long as from here to that clock back there. Got me a new set of threads, and my sponsor told me to come on down to Anaheim Club. I went down to Anaheim Club, parked my big Lincoln right out front. I was thinking some kind of a specialized license plate to put on. And I'm standing in the club trying to look cool. Pretty soon I look over and this guy walked up next to me. Weirdest looking guy you ever saw. I looked at him. I said, why don't you comb your hair? And he said, I did. I looked at him. He had a pair of pants hit him about 2 inches below his knees and had a pair of thongs on, and he'd painted his feet with shoe polish. Looked like socks, like he had socks on. I recognized that. I did it once. And he looked at me and he said, will you be my sponsor? I said, hell, I don't know. I got to ask my sponsor. And I went over and I asked my sponsor, see that guy over there? He said, yeah. I said, he just asked me to be his sponsor. He says, I know. I sent him over there. I said, well, for Christ's sake, at least you could have got one that's halfway decent. Look at that guy, man. He says, I know. It's going to be fun to watch you two grow. I went back over and I said, yeah, my sponsor says I got to be your sponsor, so come on. And he grabbed a hold of my arm. I said, where do you want to go? He said, I want to go meet your friends. Now, I was 3 years sober or better. Took me 3 years to get two friends. And I got this guy hanging on to me, and I figured just as sure as heck when my two friends see this dude, they're gone. We go up there, here he is, all googed out, and them guys said, hi, sure is going to be fun to watch you two grow. Man, I wanted to kill him. He said, that's my sponsor. And he pointed at me, and oh, geez, man. And then he says, I want to go home. And I'm thinking, I want you to go out this door and I'll go out that door because I don't want nobody seeing me getting in my big AA car with you. No, he went right out there, got right in the car, down the street we go. I said, where you live? He said, just keep driving. I'll tell you. I'm driving along and he starts telling me some stuff. Weird stuff, boy, I'm telling you. Pretty soon he says, you ever do that? Without even thinking, I start telling him some weird stuff. And we get down there, pretty soon he says, pull in this driveway. And I pull up in this driveway. He looked at me and he says, you're sick. You need a meeting. I said, wait a minute, I'm your sponsor. You don't tell your sponsor he needs a meeting. He jumped out and says, come back, get me at 8 o'clock. And he run in his house. And I'm backed out and I'm thinking, I need a meeting. This guy's driving me nuts. I went home and I laid down and I'm thinking about this guy. This is the craziest guy I ever saw in my life. Went back over to his house about 8 o'clock. He come out, looked like he just stood in there and waited on me. I said, why don't you comb your hair? He said, I did. Took off. He started talking weird, I mean really weird stuff. Got about halfway to the club and he said, you ever do that? Next thing I know, man, I'm telling him all my weird stuff. We get down to the club and he says, you're sick. You ought to do the steps. I said, I've done the steps. You're the one that ought to do the steps. He says, that's what I'm talking about. I'll be over at your house Sunday. I want to do the steps. I thought, oh, you're crazy, man. I let him out. Now, I'd moved to a nicer house. 3 and 3.5 years sober, good things start happening to you, and then you spend 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 paying for them. And that went over some of your head. I know you ain't there yet. But I got this big house in a neighborhood where they don't know what it used to be like. And I got one of them houses where you tell all newcomers to park down at the end of the block so they don't drain oil in your driveway. I hear a knock at my door. I was in there reading and spiritual stuff. I read spiritual stuff on Sunday, especially. And I'm in there having coffee, and there's a knock on my front door. And pretty soon I open the door, and there he was, all weirded out, standing there. And I seen his old car on my driveway. Must have drained 6 quarts of oil out in between. I said, get the hell in here, man. He had an old book with papers stuck in it and all kinds of stuff. And went in there in the kitchen. I said, what do you want? Said, I want to do the steps. I said, how? He said, just like you did it. I said, well, I had to get on my knees and do the third step with my sponsor. He said, that's what I want to do. He got on my knees right in the kitchen. I think, man, my wife's upstairs. If she sees me out here in the kitchen with this weird... Out the table. I said, now what? And he says, I want to do my fourth step. I said, get to your sponsor's house. He says, I can't write. And he throws these paper over at me and a pencil and he says, I'm going to talk, you write. I said, wait a minute, I'm your sponsor. He says, no, you do it this way because your sponsor told me to tell you you got to do it that way. I started writing. He's laying this weird stuff out. I wrote a page and a half, and I got to thinking, you know, if my wife comes down here and sees this, she's liable to think this stuff is mine. And I said, put an X in the margin, will you? And he'd put an X in the margin. And he said, you ever do any of that? The next thing I know, I'm telling him some real weird stuff. And I got to thinking while I'm telling him, I forgot to tell my sponsor that maybe I could just write it on his. And I started just writing. I wrote about 2 pages of my own stuff. I figured, what the hell, God's in there and he understands and this ding-dong can't read. So I'll just lay a little of my stuff on him, you know. I run a little of my stuff out there and he started talking a little more, you know, and I wrote some more of his stuff. Must have taken 2 or 3 or 4 hours. I don't know. Pretty soon he jumps up and he runs over and throws his arms around me, kissed me right on the cheek, said, I love you. I thought, oh, man, if my wife heard that up there, she knows I've done wackoed out in here. And he grabbed that stuff, tore it up, and lit it on fire, and run out the front door and stopped in the front yard and said, I love you, and away he went, down there and jumped in that old car and took off. And I slammed the front door, and I'm standing there in front of my house. Something weird and strange had happened over there, I'll guarantee you. I never felt like that before. Now, you see, I'd given all my stuff to my sponsor, and I'd got on my knee, and I'd told him all my weird and crazy stuff. And I was standing around meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous just thinking. I was thinking this. I was thinking, you know, it's okay to be sober, and I see you people just having all kinds of fun and doing all kinds of things, but I ain't never going to feel that way. You see, I'm always going to be able to reach down in there 2 inches behind my belly button and know exactly that I was what I thought I was. And I knew it was never going to get no better. I knew that for sure. And I was standing around meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and this ding-a-ling come by. And he grabbed hold of me, and he took me along. That guy was 6 years sober when he come and asked me to be his sponsor. He'd been waiting 6 years for me. And he come along and he grabbed me and he did something real weird. He let me walk beside him while he worked the step. And he let me make full circle. You see, if you come in here and you just do these steps just halfway, you're just halfway around the circle. You see, I was wandering around Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was saying things to me like, yeah, it's okay, God may forgive me, but I ain't going to forgive me. And people would say, well, if God can forgive you, why can't you forgive God, forgive yourself? And I had a pat answer to that. I'd said, because I ain't God. And they just back off. But yet that morning, standing in front of my house, I seen something. I'd never seen it before. That lady come walking down that stairs. We'd been around together a long time. She'd been going to lots of meetings. She'd been doing all kinds of things, like working with newcomers, and she'd been working the steps, and that little girl had been doing those things. And I'm standing there in the front of my house, and I'm thinking about something. I'm thinking about the look I saw in their eyes. It was kind of like the look I saw in that ding-a-ling whenever he left my house. See, when he come to my house, he was all weirded out, kind of half-cocked, and had that old book. It looked like he'd hit him on the head. He had one foot stuck in concrete and the other and headed for Tijuana. But when he left, man, he was calm, and he was full of life and full of enthusiasm. And I stood there in front of my house that morning, and I looked at this lady as they stood there, this lady and this little girl, and they looked at me. I remember something back old, maybe whenever I was a year and a half, 2 years sober, while my daughter come along one morning, and she said, Daddy, what are you doing? It was Saturday morning. She asked me maybe what I might be doing, 10:30, and I didn't have nothing. And she said, would you come down to this store? And she told me where it was. And I remember going down there. I walked in the back of a room about like this, and a lot of people in there, and I kind of hovered up against the back of the wall, and I didn't understand nothing. Because you see what she'd done, she'd started going to Alateen, and she started working her steps, and she started forgiving herself, and she started getting a little self-worth, and she took $13.50 or something like that and went down and enrolled in a modeling course. And she took the basic modeling course, and then she took $27.50 or whatever it was and went down and enrolled another modeling course, and she took her own money and she did her own thing. She didn't tell me. I was too busy just staying sober. But I walked in the back of that room, and I remembered it, and I stood against the wall, and I watched these ladies come out on the stage, beautiful ladies. Now, when I sobered up, that little girl was 12 and a half, and she had an old coat on, and it was an old coat that had a lining was ripped out of it, had an old Easter egg rolled around in the back, and it smashed, and her hair was in her face, and she was hump-shouldered, and she had no friends, and all kinds of bad things had gone in that house. I mean, I remember she brought an old dog home one time, and it would look just like her, and she's sitting on the couch one morning, and she had that dog, and I could see she was loving that dog, and she was supposed to be loving her dad, and I grabbed that dog and blowed a hole in it with a .38 right in front of her, and if you think that don't do something to a kid, you're wrong. But I remember I was a year and a half sober, and I was standing in the back of that room, and that girl come out on that stage, and she walked around, and she had some dignity and some self-worth. I didn't understand it at a year and a half sober, but I saw it, and she kind of waved at me, and I kind of waved, and I remember I stood back there, and I wanted to cry out to those people, if you only knew what kind of an animal she used to be and where we come from. But I couldn't do that because I couldn't take any credit for what she was doing. I'd just been not drinking. And yet, standing there in front of my house that Sunday morning, when I looked at that little girl, I saw something that I'd never seen before. I saw forgiveness. Forgiveness. It's in the eyes. You see, I saw love. See, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't understand a lot of things. One of the things I didn't understand was love. The only thing I knew about love was when somebody said, I love you, I knew it was my turn. You see? But, you see, you showed me something else. You showed me what love is. And see, love for a guy like me, it's an action. An action. And the first act of love for a guy like me is the act of transparency. I must let you see in so that I can see out. And you see, when I went over there and give all my stuff away to these people, and I got on my knees and I asked this God to, you know, take care of me the best I could, He did, but I just went half circle. I'd let somebody see in. But I couldn't see out till that morning when that ding-dong came over my house. And we did those things, and I shared something with him. I shared the special part of me that I'd never shared before. And whenever he left my house and went running out there in the front yard and said, I love you, and took off, I had the second greatest act of love. That's apartness in our togetherness. I let somebody know everything about me other than my sponsor, and I let them walk away from my life. You see, I never did that before. If anybody knew those things about me, I held them hostage. Because you'll for sure use it against me. But that morning when that guy left my house, it made full circle. See, it made full circle. And I could see out. And what I saw was something in this lady's eyes and in this little girl's eyes that I'd never, ever seen before. I saw a special kind of forgiveness. I knew they'd forgiven themselves because they were happy and they were laughing around and doing lots of things. Because they were involved in service and they were doing all kinds of things. But not me, man. On any given day, I wanted to be able to sit around and be my own judge, jury, and executioner. But that morning, I couldn't do it no more because that guy loved the unlovable. And he reached in there and he touched my heart. And he let me see out. And for the first time in my life, I was free. I mean free. When he used to let me out of them jails and them nut wards, I wasn't free. I was just loose because it was just a matter of time till I got back. And I could remember things. When I looked in that little girl's eyes that morning, I saw somebody alive. And I remembered a guy told me one time, he said, "You know, you can take everything away from a human being. Everything. Their wives, their families, their cars, their jobs, and everything, and they'll still be a human being. But when you take away their dignity, they got nothing left to lose, and they're as near an animal as you can be." And that's the way we used to be. Because I could remember standing in my kitchen 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, and I'd be taking a hit off a bottle of vodka, and I'd look down the hallway, and that little girl would be standing down that hallway with that old coat on, and she'd have a little purse in her hand with some money that her mommy gave her, and she'd have a couple old grocery sacks there with her stuff in it, and I'd be taking a hit off that jug, and I'd look down that hallway, and just for a second, our eyes would contact. And just for a second, I'd look at her, and she'd look at me. She didn't run down that hallway and say, "Daddy, please don't do that no more." She didn't come down there and say, "Daddy, don't beat me and Mommy." She was looking at me to see which way I was going to go so she could go the other way. And I could remember one morning when I was standing in my bathroom. I don't know what time it was, 6, 7, 8 o'clock. I was cooking up a batch of that stuff, sticking that syringe so I could slam it in my arm, and I got a bottle of peppermint schnapps sitting over there by a big mirror, and there's a crack in the door 6-8 inches wide, and I look in that mirror, and I see two eyes looking through there. It's a 9-and-a-half-year-old girl looking through the slot in that door, and she's looking in that mirror, and just for a second, her eyes caught, and just for a second, I felt the hollowness inside of myself. And I turned back around and did what I had to do, and without a sound, I looked back, and nothing was there. She was gone. And I lived on hate. And I'll tell you what hate does to a guy like me. Hate takes the beautiful and makes it ugly. And it takes the ugly and makes it beautiful. It makes true false and false true. And that's what I was living. I was living nothing. But that morning, standing in my front of my house, I felt something for the first time in my life. I felt whole. I felt like somebody. I felt like something had been given back to me. And what I recognized, there was a prayer in the 12 and 12. And there's one little thing I reached in and got a hold of and I held on to, and I've got it right now in my hand. And that's this. It is in forgiving that we are forgiven. You see, I didn't understand that. I didn't understand how to forgive myself. But that day I understood what it meant to forgive another human being. When in that guy's story, he told me one of his worst guilt trips was when he was sitting around looking at his own daughter lusting over and thinking, "Am I going to act or not?" And she came up and crawled up and got in his lap, and she'd made a flower out of a piece of paper, and she said, "Daddy, I love you. Here's a flower that'll never die." And thank God he didn't have to act on those thoughts. And we sit there that morning and we cried about those kind of things, and they weren't tears of sorrow, they were tears of joy, because that's the real forgiveness. To know that I was a human being. You see, I had it all wrong. I didn't understand. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I always wanted to be the meanest man on the face of the earth. And I had it down pat. I tried everything. I tried everything, and all I did was attract the things I feared the most. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you showed me how to attract the things that I love the most. And you showed me what that meanest man on the face of the earth is. It's that little guy who lives down the street in the house. He's got a wife and a kid and a dog or a cat. And he can get up in the morning and go in there and take a shower, and he can put on a clean set of threads and walk in the kitchen, and he can put his arms around his wife and say, "Baby, I love you. I hope you have a nice day." And he can walk across that house and put his arms around his daughter and say, "Baby, I love you, and I hope you walk down the sunny side of the street today." And he don't have to kick the dog or the cat, and he can go out and get in the car and drive down that street, and he don't have to flip the crosswalk lady off. He can get on over there to that job with them crap heads and work all day long, and he can get his check and bring it home and put it in the bank, and he can pay his bills, and he can lay down and take a nap, and he can get up and come to a place like this, and he can laugh and cry and kiss him goodbye. You see, that takes guts to do that. It takes real guts. I'm glad that there was a guy when I first walked into that meeting that recognized me, and he saw right through me, and he'd come up to me and he'd punch me right in the chest. And he said, "If you think you're tough, let's see you stay sober." And he wasn't kidding, because it takes everything you got, and then some. You see, I'm glad, because today I am that man. I know that, you see, because ever since I got up this morning, I've been around and around, up and down. I've seen them all, the long ones, the short ones, and the rich ones, and the poor ones. And from the second I got up to this second right now, I've not seen one person or thought of anybody that I'd rather be than me. You gave me that. You gave me back my dignity. I know that because I can stand here and look you in the eye. I can share my story and let you see in. And when I say I love you, I know I can see out. Thank you.